Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 22, Transfiguring Adoption, where we will be talking with Margie Fink about her organization that uses the Harry Potter books to help adoptive families and foster families. Thanks for joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I am your host, Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. Today, my co-host is Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions at Mount Carmel College of Nursing, and the author of numerous Harry Potter essays. Thanks for being my co-host today, Emily.
It is my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I think we have a really cool topic today.
Yeah. Excited about this.
This is going to be very interesting. Our special guest today is Margie Fink, Executive Director of Transfiguring Adoption, an organization that develops media, resources, and tools that nurture growth in foster and adoptive children. She studies in psychology, has worked in the field of social work, and is herself a foster and adoptive mom who, as she says, quote, is able to give kids from hard places loving structure while providing unbelievable homemade cooking. Which sounds like Molly Weasley to me, so that sounds wonderful. In addition to her work with Transfiguring Adoption, she's also co-founded the organization Community Kids to assist adoptive, foster, and relative caregiver families. Welcome to the show, Margie.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also joining us today are two other experts in this area. Dr. Louise Freeman is a professor of psychology at Mary Baldwin University and the author of Studies of PTSD in Harry Potter and Other Young Adult Literature. And we're also pleased to be joined today by adoptive mom and Harry Potter scholar, Dr. Lana Whited. She is professor of English at Ferrum College, organizer of the Roanoke Generic Magic Festival, and one of the first to publish an academic anthology on Harry Potter, The Ivory Tower and Harry Potter, which I loved. When it first came out. Really loved that book. She also has four adoptive sons who have varying levels of engagement with the Harry Potter series, the books, and the movies. Welcome back to the show, Louise and Lana.
Thank you so much. It's always fun to be here.
Wonderful. All right, well, let's go right ahead and sort of figure out what it is that you or your organization has as its mission. So, Margie, tell us about your organization, Transfiguring Adoption, and how you came up with the idea to use the Harry Potter stories to help foster and adoptive children and families.
Well, my husband and I started our own journey as foster and adoptive parents about a decade ago, and we started doing support groups and different resources at the time, just, you know, seeing needs and trying to fill in some gaps. At the time, we lived in Illinois, and then in 2012, we moved to Tennessee, and we kind of weren't doing a whole lot, and we stumbled upon using Harry Potter kind of by accident. We're celebrating everybody. We have four children, all adopted out of foster care, and we were going to go celebrate everybody's adoptions. And we discovered that just the kids missed out on just a lot of the classics. You know, we were going to be going to Universal and Disney to celebrate, and they didn't know who Mickey Mouse was.
Oh, wow.
And so at the same time, you know, they didn't really have great imaginations or reading skills or even an ability to really play or pretend. So in an effort to kind of develop that in them and to bond with them, we started reading Harry Potter so that they would know what it was about when we went to Universal Studios. And first chapter, we're sitting at the dining room table, and one of our children, who really didn't talk much about their trauma and really had a hard time connecting in terms of bodily and, you know, physical and emotional feelings, didn't know, you know, I'm happy, tired, sad, angry, very dissociated from that. Started just tearing up, and you know, this was very new. We're like, hey, what's going on? And he said, you know, I can relate to Harry Potter. And we said, well, tell us about that. And he just kind of started sharing all this stuff, trauma and different things from his past that he'd never talked about before with anybody. And we just saw so much power in the media to be able to connect as a family and also to process some things from the past in a non-threatening way. So, you know, it's kind of that safe space. You can process complex feelings. And you don't even necessarily have to say, hey, this happened to me, but you can talk about a character, process some feelings. You know, and it wasn't just Harry Potter that we were seeing that with lots of different media, with from songs, books, just opening doors to healing conversations, being able to process and talk about different ways to solve problems. There's just so much to it. It kind of started with Harry Potter, and the kids at the time, my husband and I were working in social media, and the kids were always wanting to do stuff online, and like, well, you can't post to the pizza restaurant's webpage, but they said, hey, can we start a blog? So we would go through chapter by chapter and kind of say, as a family, just discuss the chapter and say, what can a foster or adoptive child learn through this chapter? How can a family discuss it? What are some discussion questions? And then my husband and I would do the same thing for the parents. So we did that through Sorcerer's Stone and then part of the second book. And in the meantime, we started, you know, really saying, okay, there's a lot of media out there that our kids can connect to, but it's not always easy to find. You know, you can go to the library and Barnes & Noble and find books, you know, Mommy had you in her tummy and we brought you home from the hospital and we love you forever. And that's just not our kids' story. There are resources out there, but they're not always easy to find. Sometimes they have trauma triggers that aren't good for kids. So we started creating different media lists. And as we got our hands on media, we would start reviewing it, kind of reading rainbow style, and also creating discussion guides for the family.
You have discussion guides for the parents as well as for the kids. I think that's so important so that there's a real conversation between them.
Yeah, and there's so much to learn. I mean, there's so many different caregivers in the Harry Potter series, so there's so much to learn even as adults.
And I think that's really important as well. And I think, because I think people, they sense, they have kind of instinctual reactions to these stories that help them process things, but sometimes they need help articulating that to their loved ones and to especially finding ways that children can relate to. I was wondering, and this is so cool, I was thinking when you were saying, you know, that this created this safe space, I was like, it's like a room of requirement, you know? It's like this, Harry Potter's provided this room of requirement for you to discuss these traumatic issues in a safe way. But I wondered about the title of your organization, Transfiguring Adoption. What is it about transfiguration is just such an alluring, magical subject to me. Interesting. There's so many different facets of it. So tell me about why you chose to highlight that in the title of your organization. What is it about transfiguration in particular that speaks to your cause?
Yeah. So when we were kind of trying to come up with a name, when we originally started the blog, it was Hogwarts Adoption, and it was just, you know, it wasn't supposed to be, you know, anything other than just a family project. Well, then we decided, okay, we're going to change the name, obviously, so it doesn't infringe on copyrights. So we started just looking up different words, what might be copyrighted, you know, trademarked, what's not. And we started thinking about the word transfigure. In the dictionary, it says it means to transform into something more beautiful or elevated. The thing about foster care and adoption is it always begins with loss and trauma. You know, 100% of kids, if they've been removed from their birth families, you know, there's more and more science behind even those kids who are never even stay with their birth mom for any amount of time. There's still loss and grief and trauma. So they all have trauma in some way, shape, or form. And the foster parents and adoptive parents often are not prepared to handle the things that are brought on by trauma or sexual abuse or PTSD, malnutrition, so many issues that our kids have to deal with. So 50% of foster parents quit the first year. You know, so it's you know, a lot of times it's portrayed as this beautiful thing, but and it can be, but it's also very messy and very hard. Our hope is that with the right resources, families can begin the process of healing, and we can take something and transfigure it, making it into something more beautiful, a little less difficult, whatever we can do to make it better for those families.
That's so beautiful. That's just very poignant.
That word transfiguration is really one that she kind of borrows, that Rowling borrows from probably from the New Testament, because it's a word used to describe what happens to Jesus in front of his disciples, where he's transfigured and becomes white and God appears, and it's like this confirmation of who he is. So it's really interesting that you went that route, because that's copyright safe.
That's right. No TM after transfiguring. Yeah. Tell me, Margie, why do you think reading together is especially helpful for foster and adoptive families? What is it about reading itself? I know there's other media there too, but you focus a lot on the idea of reading together.
You know, we've seen just so much power in it. And then, as we were kind of looking into it ourselves, we discovered, this is not something new. For centuries, therapists have been using bibliotherapy, and that is the use of literature. And, therapists will assign books as, like homework for clients. And like I said before, it's just this safe place that's developed in sitting together, and it's non-threatening. You can talk about the character and not necessarily what happened to you individually. It's a great way to kind of stand. There are a lot of therapeutic books on our list, from things like food hoarding or meltdowns, just different things that our kids have to deal with. And in a quiet moment when kids aren't escalated, it's a great way to kind of sit down and look at, first of all, it normalizes things for them. Hey, I'm not the only one dealing with this. Mm-hmm. And it's also a way to kind of look at creative problem solving, or saying, what went well with this or what didn't go well? How can we face a similar situation, and start to kind of bring some connections in there, just in all the different situations of life?
Yeah, and it's a reflective process. I love how, reading it's in your head, so you get to do with it what you want, as opposed to the movies that are putting something on you. I think that's really cool. So what experiences do foster and adoptive children have that make these Harry Potter books specifically especially relevant to them?
Well, some of it's just the everyday, things that all kids face. Right. We're looking at 7 years of development in the characters. But there's just so much. If you look at Harry, Neville is also a character that a lot of our kids can relate to. And just things like searching for identity, wondering what might have been, longing for birth parents, longing for belonging, that, being moved to new caregivers, or being raised by, like Neville's raised by his grandmother, questioning their self-worth. And then like the everyday stuff, like how do you choose friends? How do you kind of decipher who's a safe person, who's not a safe person? There's just so much depth to the book.
Yeah.
So many different things that can be talked about.
And Lana, I think you were talking about relating to some of the identity questions that Margie brought up there, that the Harry Potter books deal with pretty well.
Yeah, it seems to me that that's one of the major appeals of the series for children who've had experience in foster care or experience with adoption. Think of all the people who try to find their birth parents in real life. Stories that we see on Facebook, especially now that there are DNA databases that help to make these connections. And think about, in the Harry Potter series, the contrast between people like the Weasleys, who have this kind of strong sense of family identity, who have so much connection, including physical connection, because they live with their birth family and they all look similar, so that people can look at Ron, for example, and say, oh, you're a Weasley. Red hair and freckles, you're a Weasley. Having red hair and freckles, I can relate to that, even though I'm not a Weasley. But that strong sense of personal identity, I mean, even Draco Malfoy has that kind of strong sense of identity because he has those two parents who dote on him. And compare that to the angst of the children who don't live with their biological parents. Harry and Neville are great examples. Tom Riddle is another really great example. Mm. He may not be a character whom lots of readers identify with, hopefully not, but in terms of this idea about not knowing who you are, and he has actually outright rejected his father's identity by killing his own father, and is really devastated by that problem of not really knowing who he is. I was thinking, after you asked me to participate in this discussion, about the fact that even when Tom Riddle changes his name, his new name still contains all the letters that go with his old name. Mm-hmm. You know, it's as though he can maybe transfigure himself by having this new name and having this new sort of persona, but the other person is still in there. And the anagram of his name is such a lovely kind of metaphor, I guess, for that. Not knowing your identity is frightening in ways that are probably obvious to us, not knowing who our parents are, where they are, whether we might pass them on the street. Two of my sons were born just two counties over from us, and occasionally when we're traveling, they'll recognize a place where they spent some time during their childhood. We still have contact with the foster family where my youngest son lived for a while, and that is good for him. But, you know, occasionally they'll recognize usually something, but the other aspect of that is not the fear, but the fact that it can be kind of exciting not to know about your identity, because you can fantasize about who your birth parents are. You know, maybe they're these fabulous people. Maybe they're famous. Maybe they're heroes. Maybe they're even gods. And I think this is a theme that Rowling is so incredibly interested in. It also shows up in the Cormoran Strike series and those questions about Cormoran and his famous father, Johnny Rokeby, and, you know, the little bit that we learn and are kind of putting together about his mother. Louise had a great post about that recently on Hogwarts Professor. But also in the Fantastic Beasts series, with the character of Credence and the way that it's so devastating to him, you know, not to know about his identity and to have so much angst about that, that he can conjure this really devastating force, which is called the Obscurus. I mean, think about the name of that really strong emotional force, that what it does is to obscure, in the same way that the process of being separated from your family of origin obscures so much important information about your identity that some people are never able to rediscover.
And the stories themselves engaging with those issues help the kids to not only see a wide variety of ways of dealing with it, but also they can play out maybe some of the fantasy.
Yeah, what Margie was saying earlier reminded me of that study with, I think his name is Loris Vitsali, the Italian researcher who did that prejudice study that involved the principle of perspective taking, having young people read these passages from the Harry Potter books and put themselves in the positions of the characters and talk about the scene, for example, in Chamber of Secrets when Draco calls Hermione a mudblood. Harry doesn't know what that means. That principle of perspective taking, it's one of the great sources of power in literature. That we can think about those experiences, many of which ultimately happen to us, and that sort of vicariously helps us to think about what we would do or what we should do in those situations.
Margie, what are some of your favorite reactions from children and parents?
Well, my favorite is our personal story, of course. But aside from our story, I think some of my favorite reactions have actually been when we've met former foster youth or adult adoptees or even current foster youth, when we've been at conventions or different places, who've looked at our discussion guide and said, man, I wish that would have been around for my parents when I was a kid, because they felt like the books were really powerful and life-changing for them, but would have been even more so had they had that discussion guide to use as a family.
That's really important, too. You know, you can kind of see, oh, I wish I had had this, and then make use of that in the next generation. I do think it's just a really wonderful idea. I know that Chris Rankin, who is Percy Weasley in the Harry Potter films, he has also gotten involved in your organization. He was adopted. How did he get involved, and how did you connect up with him?
We actually met Chris at a convention in 2017, and it was a smaller convention, so Darren had a chance to really just kind of hang out with a lot of the talent and just talk to them about what we do and talk to them how their portrayal of the characters and stuff has such an impact on our children, our family, and so many other people, and just thanking them for using their talents in that way. And you know, in the process of talking about it, Chris said, well, hey, I'm adopted. And, you know, everybody kind of looks at him like, really? and he later on started, he blogged. It's not something I talk a lot about, not like he's ashamed of it or anything, but it was just part of his story. So he started blogging about it and just kind of told us, however you can, you know, however I can be involved. So he's signed different things for us. He's, we have an adoptive parent award that's named after him. And he's really just been getting involved in whatever way he can. And it's been really neat getting to work with him and even some of the other folks from Andromeda Talent and his amazing girlfriend, Vanessa.
That's wonderful. I saw a really cute video that you have a link to on your website, transfiguringadoption.com, of him opening a package for the Elf Squad. Can you tell us what the Elf Squad is?
Yeah, so the Elf Squad is our volunteer mobilization, and it kind of started out as a grassroots thing. We had some folks that were really wanting to get involved in the early days, and we really didn't have a good way to plug them in. So we had some folks that said, hey, we want to head up this charge of helping people that want to volunteer get involved with Transfiguring Adoption. So they called themselves the Elf Squad, and it kind of started out online, and now it's developed into more local chapters, because we do things like, currently right now we're doing a nightlight drive. It's something small and simple, but it has a profound impact on particularly foster children as they're going to a stranger's house and the stranger says, hey, you're safe here. But what they know is adults hurt me, lie to me, and scary things happen in the dark. You can give them a nightlight, and that just gives them it's a tiny bit of empowerment that helps them sleep better. When something goes bump in the night, they can look around and say, hey, there's really nobody creeping on me. I really am. They can see for themselves so that they can feel safe, because we in our heads know that they're safe, but they don't.
It's Lumos.
Yes. Lumos, right.
So cool.
Yeah. So the Elf Squads, you know, we started out doing those drives and such, and people would ship them to us, but then we didn't have a way to really make sure that, you know, if someone in Georgia is donating a nightlight, that it stays in Georgia. So it's kind of, they are our boots on the ground, so they can go and find a local business and say, hey, will you be our drop-off location for this drive that we're doing? So people in their locale can take nightlights to a certain restaurant or a different business and drop off the nightlights, and then we connect them to an agency that's local that wants the donations. So we've done this several times now, and it's just been a really great way for people to use their fandom in a powerful way. Some, you know, we have Elf Squad members who don't even like kids, but this is their way that they can help. So we have our Elf Squad kit, which is what Chris and Vanessa were unwrapping, and it's kind of the first year membership kit. Has some elf ears and a drawstring bag, and let's see what else, a couple of our stickers and a shirt. Each year, we've started developing renewal kits that have little sock pins. And so I've got my 2018 and 2019 renewal pins on my elf hat. But that's what they were unpacking that video, and they put the hat on the dog, and it's just, we just love
very
that
cute.
Video.
Yeah. And I wonder, you know, we sort of joked about the, you know, the trademarking and copywriting of like Transfiguration, but I wondered if you have heard anything from Rowling or Warner Brothers about the way that you're making use of the Harry Potter series?
We have not. You know, we've talked about, we would love to at some point actually talk to Rowling, because, you know, we started this blog before we even knew about her organization, Lumos. And I found it just so fascinating when we were actually on our way to Universal for a celebration of Harry Potter driving across the country. And I just found this tweet, and I said, Lumos. And I saw something about it being for kids and deinstitutionalization. And I looked it up, and Darren and I actually spent 2 years in Korea, and we did some work in some orphanages there, and just, we have a passion as well for that deinstitutionalization. And the reality is, you know, without even meaning to, if you deinstitutionalize children, those kids have been traumatized. And whether they go back to their birth family, or they go to relatives, or they go to a foster or adoptive home, those caregivers are going to need support and tools for helping them. So it's kind of like a really neat connection that we didn't even plan.
I think right. She would love what you're doing with Harry Potter. I mean, I just think it's right along the lines of where her sensibilities are. where her drive is to help the world as well.
I'm even wondering if that's, you know, because when I first looked at your website, I was like, oh, they've got the font. Oh no, they've got the font, you know, like, because people
it's
have
not
gotten
the exact font. We've been very, very careful. My husband Darren, my husband and the co-founder, is actually an artist. And so he's really careful too. You know, tends to be very careful about trademark and stuff because he doesn't want anybody taking his art either.
Well, you've done well, and maybe you know your cause is close enough to J.K. Rowling's own heart that certain blind eyes are turned. But I don't know. You know, I think you're right. I think it really lines up with some of what she is most passionate about, Margie. And I wonder, you've already kind of talked about, just kind of get us back into the books a little bit. You've already talked about Neville and you've talked about Harry as character kind of touch points for children, especially. But what about other characters that seem to resonate most strongly, both for children and for their parents? What are some of your favorite kind of character points for discussion?
Yeah, well, it was mentioned before, Hermione, actually, you know, when you're talking about identity and belonging, that her being called a mudblood, we ended up talking a lot about that in the discussion guides. There's just so many. She really wrote such a complex, great group of characters. So there's some of everybody that, you know, we can connect to for some, in some ways. With Tom Riddle, you've got kids who've been institutionalized and the trauma that they've experienced. And I love Professor McGonagall as a caregiver. You know, she's strict, but yet you can tell she's at the same time, you know, as she's strict and structured, she's also nurturing and she truly loves the kids. You know, there's Hagrid and Professor Snape. They all have different aspects of them. You know, one of the things that we talked about a lot in the early days of, you know, the first book was the Dursleys. As caregivers, you know, everyone really tends to villainize them. As caregivers, I think we can also learn a lot from them because you see in them, you know, as human beings, fear is one of our biggest drivers for behavior. And in them, you know, they kind of had their normal middle-class life, you know, and this fear of what's happened to Petunia's sister and, you know, they're so fearful of the magical world that I think that drives a lot of that negative behavior, you know, and just the lack of understanding. And I feel like a lot of times when foster and adoptive parents get into this journey, they want to love on kids, but there is a lot of times a lack of understanding of trauma and how it impacts behavior. There's fears of what ifs, or, you know, what's going to happen if I get involved with a birth family. And there's just so much there that, you know, we kind of started saying, how much were they really these awful people? And how much was just they got thrown into this situation way over their heads and they were scared and they didn't understand.
Yeah, that's very wise. You know, I think it's easy to pile on the Dursleys, but, yeah. You know, they've got their own things they're dealing with. And, you know, Dumbledore does remark that Harry came out of that situation better than he worried that he would. So there was something there. Margie, I was really struck by the discussion of Dobby the house elf. In the materials you present, Dobby is a personal favorite of mine. And some of the discussion that you had to do with a variety of aspects of Dobby, but the self-harm was part of it. Also trying to help out, but actually doing things that, you know, created more problems, those kinds of things. Do you find that young people connect with Dobby's character?
Yeah, he is so beloved by so many.
Yeah,
you see him being treated as less than human for all intents and purposes. He's abused, so you see just this lack of self-worth. You see people not considering his feelings, and I think a lot of times, especially for foster and adoptive kids, their feelings weren't always considered. You know, mm-hmm. A lot of times there's adults making lifelong decisions for them. Without their input, and they get shuffled around and feel like they're not being listened to, And they don't have a lot of self-worth so many times from just abuse and neglect and things, you know, rejection, abandonment. And you see some of this self-punishing and self-harm and or sabotaging. You've got a really good thing coming and they don't feel like they're worth that really good thing. And so they will, a lot of times not even consciously, just sabotage these good things. We've seen our kids, you know, put punishments on themselves. They do something and then all of a sudden it's like they're grounded and all their good things are taken away. And we're like, we didn't do that, you know? So yeah, and the self-harm. And then in the end, you know, he gets the sock, which gives him identity and freedom. And and at the same time, you know, as Hermione's talking about freeing the elves, they don't know how to operate outside of that.
Yeah, and I do think Dobby is such a good character. You know, he's very small and childlike also, but then he have a transfiguration over the story arc of the seven-book series.
Oh, yes.
He's just the biggest hero of the whole thing because he comes from such a place of feeling marginalized and, like you said, like nobody even thinks about him as a person, to being able to take charge and to act heroic. Yeah. I think that's just, to me, such a profound profound transformation. And he's doing it, a lot of it, on his own, which is powerful too.
Yes, it's a transfiguration.
Yes.
If you will.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, Louise, you have done some of your psychology research in examining PTSD in young adult literature and especially the Harry Potter series. What do you think is the value of the Harry Potter series in helping people to understand the issue of PTSD?
I have written a paper that included a discussion of Mad-Eye Moody and as a character who kind of personifies or in some ways even caricatures the symptoms of PTSD, most notably the mad eye, the hypervigilance, the constant jumpiness. He's very much in the line of a combat veteran who has developed PTSD after much, much trauma, which, you know, it's clear from his very body that that's what has happened to him. You know, that's just one of a number of mental illnesses that are depicted in the Harry Potter series. I've talked about this before. You have the Dementors as a personification of clinical depression, for instance. But, you know, a number of years ago, I did a survey of college students. This is a project I did with the Mary Baldwin Global Honors students as part of a human morality class that I was team teaching with one of our philosophy professors. And we surveyed students just to find out how familiar with Harry Potter they were. And it turns out the Harry Potter readers, the ones who had read the entire seven-book series, when we surveyed them about their attitudes toward people with mental illness, they were more accepting, less stigmatizing, and more likely to say, answer yes to a question like, for instance, would you be comfortable if you knew your professor had PTSD? So, you know, I don't think this is a unique trait of Harry Potter. There's been a whole host of research out there showing how exposure to fiction helps develop empathy. But when you see characters facing these magical versions of mental illnesses and triumphing over them, I mean, Harry fights off the Dementors, I think that really is both encouraging to people who are facing these types of situations themselves, and I think creates compassion and empathy for them.
Yeah, and we were talking earlier about this idea of bibliotherapy, which I'm not sure if this is new or not, but Margie mentioned this, the importance of reading itself as a way to work through issues.
Is not new. Going back to the time of Freud, the idea of using narrative in therapy, telling stories, creating your own story, looking at other people's story, and using this as a touching point for discussion. That has a long history. But I think the Harry Potter series has been particularly useful in this type of work with children.
I've been doing a little bit of research about it. There are entire books written on how to use the Harry Potter series in therapy. There was a study published just a couple of years ago, interviews with kids about how they related to Harry Potter and how much introspection, how much self-examination of themselves and their own relationships came about it as the result of really getting into and becoming a fan of Harry Potter. One of the young ladies who was interviewed talked about a friend of hers who had this boy that really liked her and who did not reciprocate his feelings, but, you know, thinking of the story of Snape and Lily made her think differently about that situation and about his feelings, and to perhaps be more kind to him than she would have been otherwise, rather than get away from me, you creep, I don't like you, to wow. step into his shoes and say, okay, yes, here is the pain that comes from loving someone who does not return your feelings, and wow, here is a case where someone was able to perhaps be more compassionate. So that was just one example.
And that's really fascinating. And I wonder about that because this is kind of, I've been dealing with this a little bit myself because I've just finished reading book 4 to my 7-year-old. So we kind of been taking it slow. He started when he was 5 with Harry Potter, but we've been taking it kind of slow because we know that the books, especially at the end of 4, they really turn much darker. And, you know, there was a recent editorial in the Wall Street Journal that complained about how dark children's literature has become and even blaming such disturbing, you know, quote unquote, disturbing literature for a lot of teens' depression and anxiety. Now, I'm not, you know, I'm not endorsing this editorial because I don't think that we can quite blame that. But I do wonder where the kind of edge is of the benefits of this and where does it drop off into something where you have to kind of watch how dark the literature is becoming. What do you think? Or is there a value, you know, in engaging with literature even when it goes into those dark places? And maybe the question becomes how dark is too dark? You know, so how do you make those judgments? And I would address that question to both Louise and to Margie as well.
I mean, from my perspective, I think, you know, parents definitely need to be the judge of what their kids can handle. I think my son wanted to read The Hunger Games when he was 12. And I've had actually colleagues who have approached me, knowing I've written about The Hunger Games, and told me their 8 or 10-year-olds wanted to read that series. And I usually point out that Suzanne Collins has written this other series called Gregor the Overlander, which is aimed toward younger children. And why don't you start with that? That's what we did with my son. We read Gregor the Overlander first. But, you know, I don't think darkness is inherently dangerous. If I know the editorial you're talking about, Emily, I think I wrote a rebuttal to that because
yes,
you did.
Every bit of research I have read about and done myself has shown that literature just doesn't seem to cause mental illnesses. It seems to create compassion for people with mental illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
So now it doesn't mean every book is appropriate for every child. If a kid who has experienced the death of a parent, you might want to approach Harry Potter differently than a kid who has not. But in general, there's just not a lot of evidence for harmful effects of quality books when they are presented in an age-appropriate fashion. Mm-hmm. And yes, I would not hand an 8-year-old The Hunger Games. I don't think, however, the darkness. It's interesting. One of the studies I was talking about in the essay I wrote was one I did with a sixth grade English teacher who had read Wonder with her class. And, you know, Wonder obviously is a book aimed at younger children. It's a very uplifting, you know, at the end, very happy story. But there are some difficult moments in that. I mean, this kid is stigmatized. He is bullied, not only by other students. He is bullied in some cases by parents. There's a parent who airbrushes him out of the class picture. And there's some very cruel things that happen. Yet what we found in this book is that kids who read it after they read it, they expressed a better ability to take others' perspectives. This is an important thing. We saw the same thing with The Crossover, which was, Kwame Alexander's Newbery Award-winning book, ends with the death of the father by the heart attack. You know, this is, again, a hard topic, but the kids were more empathetic after they read it.
Margie, I'm curious what you think about it. You had actually talked about triggers and maybe being sensitive mm-hmm. to what might trigger a child in reading that you're doing.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot, and really emphasizing just that the parents are familiar with any media that they're going to use with a child or let a child see beforehand, because they do know what might trigger their child. There was a period of time where we had to make sure the news was never on, because even a positive story, we had a child who, you know, really kind of catastrophized things. And even if it was a bad thing that happened with a good ending, they focused on that bad thing. And any bad thing that could happen is going to happen to me right now, today. So we had to turn off the news for several years because, you know, it was just like, we lived in the Midwest, and there was going to be an earthquake, a hurricane, a mudslide, a rape on the subway. Like, you know, we didn't have these things, but it was going to happen today. You know, just this very, the child had PTSD, and there was just a lot of fear and anxiety about everything in life. So we had to really, really be careful about different media. But the reality is that there is darkness in our world, and our kids are going to face it. Now, with bibliotherapy, it really mandates that, you know, we don't just hand our kid a book and say, here, go read. You know, we focus on, let's do this together, let's discuss this, so we have a safe, stable adult that can help the child process.
Right.
And it's not just the child who might have, you know, some warped perception because of their trauma, them just processing it on their own and coming up with their own ideas. It's the teachable moments as a family saying, you know, this is what happened, and processing it in a healthy way.
So it sounds like really dealing with dark things in a literary context is a more controlled way to deal with them than, you know, like you said. I mean, because we deal with darkness on the news every night, and we deal with darkness, you know, in the halls of our schools, and you know. So yeah, that's really interesting. I'm so intrigued by what you're doing, but I do wonder if you have encountered any resistance to your use of Harry Potter specifically, whether it's from people who feel that the magic in Harry Potter violates their religious beliefs, or maybe even from people who aren't into fantasy. Like, I have a sister she says, I just never got it. I don't object to it at all. I just kind of don't get that type of literature. Do you deal with that, or and what do you do when you meet those kind of objections?
We haven't really faced any major resistance. And I think that's because, you know, we kind of started out with the Harry Potter discussion guide, but we branched out so much from there that it's just kind of a small percent of what we do now. But we know that Harry Potter is not for every child or family. For some children, it would be too triggering. For some children, they're just too young and they need different resources. And like you said, there's others who aren't into fantasy. Mm-hmm. So we offer so many alternative media resources for all ages and interests. So we don't really get a lot, especially nowadays, because it is such, you know, such a varied part of what we are doing. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I think in general terms, Harry Potter has become a gateway to a variety of children's literature and, like you said, media resources. And so just even having that as, you know, as just your little open doorway, people, you know, can know that they're not only going to get resources related to Harry Potter, but that there'll be other things there too. And that's maybe something that we're seeing, you know, one of the things John Granger says all the time is like, we're living in the age of Harry Potter, where that's become the common text that we, mm-hmm. you know, that we all kind of associate with maybe even a particular time in your life. And, you know, having that as kind of your opening point, but then there are lots of other things that people can find for resources there too.
Yeah, it's just been a great catalyst to help people see that there is this great way to connect, to bond, to process, to heal, just centered around media.
Lana, I wondered if you would mind, you say that some of your sons have been interested in the Harry Potter series, but maybe others not. And I wondered if you have a kind of perspective on this.
I would say that all my sons have been interested in the Harry Potter series, but to varying degrees and in different ways. I have one son who's very auditory, and he certainly has read the entire Harry Potter series, but primarily by listening to it on Audible and mm-hmm. by reading it with his parents. I have one son who I can say confidently read the entire series in books at least once. I think he's listened to it as well. And I have two other sons who I think maybe read the first book or two and have seen all the movies repeatedly. All my sons, except one, have been campers in the summer enrichment program in which I have taught a course called Hogwarts Academy for about 10 or 12 years now. It's a course for middle schoolers. You know, I am given to over-intellectualizing situations sometimes. I have a very close friend who's a developmental psychologist. And occasionally I say words that it's really stupid for parents to say, I think, especially when the children were younger, like locus of control. And my youngest son feels perfectly free to say to me, Mom, I don't want to hear your psychobabble right now. But talking about things that happen in the Harry Potter series kind of puts some distance in a way that allows them to talk about those feelings, I think, in a kind of a safe space. I guess that's the thing I like best about it. One of my biggest regrets about all the work I've done on the Harry Potter series is that my sons came along too late. With the exception of my son Brandon, who came first, they really came along too late for the bookstore experience. And I can't even begin to tell you how much I regret that. But certainly we've had other kinds of experiences that help to make up for that. They very frequently give me Harry Potter gifts when I have a birthday or when it's Christmas or something like that. And I have to tell you, my family's, maybe I should say my very favorite Harry Potter story involving my children. My youngest son was probably most likely of all my sons to go around the house acting out things that happened in the Harry Potter series. As Louise would agree, I think youngest children tend to be more dramatic maybe than some other children in the birth order. But
hey, now,
when he was learning Harry Potter spells, he used to run around the house with a wand that somebody probably made in my summer class yelling, "Stupid fly, stupid fly, stupid fly." And his brothers would tease him relentlessly about that. But after the summer in which he was in my middle school class, he knew my schedule for that class. He knew what day I talked about charms. And there was a day when he was not a camper anymore, but he was hanging out on campus. And he came over to my building, and I realized when I got to the point that I normally told the campers the stupid fly story, he was hanging around outside in the hallway. It really moves me to think about this. He wanted to hear me tell that story. Aww. To my campers. He wanted to hear Mom talk about him. And it's really a good story about the importance of the Harry Potter series and the relationships in my family. I will say I've done a lot of really, really hard things. I have never done anything as hard as trying to raise children whose early lives were characterized by trauma. And I will be honest enough to say I don't think I've been completely successful. I think most adoptive parents feel that way. I don't know how you feel about that, Margie, but you know, there are times when I feel like I've just failed on a grand scale.
Yes, we have Monday caregiver check-ins live that we do on Facebook, and I think that's one of the biggest things. People get together and just sometimes, you know, people ask a question like, "What would you do in this instance?" And I'll say, you know, well, on my most therapeutic great day, this is how I would respond. The reality is most of the time that doesn't happen, but this is the way it should be handled. You know,
right? Yeah, that's true. What my one of my sons saw the same counselor from the time he was 5 years old until probably he was around 16 or 17. And he didn't always see her on a regular basis. Sometimes he saw her sporadically. One of the really wonderful things that happened in our family is that we found this woman who was truly gifted in dealing with children who'd experienced trauma, who'd experienced PTSD. There were things she finally got my son to say after maybe 4 or 5 years that we needed to know. I mean, it really took that long for him to feel comfortable enough to say it. But at the end of the time that he spent with her, when he decided he didn't need to see her anymore, I thought, what about me? I mean, I've benefited enormously from seeing this woman every 2 weeks or once a month or whatever. So I think it really is important to have that support for caregivers, just because it's so difficult. It is so difficult to do this.
Yes.
You know, hearing you, Lana, say that, and hearing Margie say that about your own imperfections as a parent and your own failures, feelings of failure as a parent, it just reminded me of the way Dumbledore is at the end of book 7 when he's talking to Harry in King's Cross Station and the kind of attitude he has about his own role in Harry's story. You know, I mean, he puts in that conversation, if I remember correctly, he puts all of the praise on Harry. He doesn't congratulate himself. You know, he's kind of humble and he feels like despite his own failings, Harry has succeeded. And that this is like kind of beyond his wildest hopes and wildest dreams. And just making more Harry Potter connections.
Oh, I think that's a great yeah. point, Emily. And that's a great example. And one of the things I really love about Dumbledore.
Wow. You know, I just thinking about Margie, you kind of let us off talking about how difficult it is and how caregivers need resources, just like the children coming into their families need resources. And this is just so powerful way, such a powerful way to think about that, and that books, and particularly the Harry Potter books, can be a really good resource for both. For our listeners out there, how can they get involved in your organization, Margie? What are some things they might be able to do?
Well, first of all, we have all the social media, so that's a great way to kind of get in touch with what we're doing and to keep up. We do have Transfiguring Adoption has a Facebook page, but we have Transfiguring Adoption Elf Squad, which is a group page, and that's really the page where our elf squads, which are kind of 50% Harry Potter social club and 50% social activism, and you know, with our elf squads, our goal is really to help educate them, because we want to be the oxygen mask for the caregivers, you know, just like on the airlines, you know. Mm-hmm. If we can give them the tools and resources, that helps kids not get disrupted and have to move again, compounding their trauma. There's so much we really want to do for the caregivers. So if we can educate our elf squads in fun ways, help them understand the issues that foster and adoptive families are facing, so they're able to kind of step up. They know what those folks need. Right now, we've got elf squads active in Texas. There's a couple going on in Florida, Virginia, Kentucky, Washington State. So those folks, we've got local leaders who are kind of heading up the charge. If anybody is interested in starting an elf squad in an area that we don't have going, there's a spot on our website that they can actually put in an application. Of course, this is non-paid, it's volunteer. But our local elf squads are really, really the ones who are doing so much magic in their local areas. You know, right now we have our elf squadders doing our nightlight drive, like I spoke about earlier. So our drives that we have, of course, we are a nonprofit, 501c3. So donating or purchasing our merchandise, Darren's been actively creating a new third party store on our website that's just absolutely amazing. I can say that I'm a little bit biased, but you know, and as we're developing, I mean, if anybody knows a corporation that would is looking for doing some good, we could use corporate sponsors. Really, right now, we're in an area, in a spot where we really have so much we want to do and growth, but we need more funding to do that.
I would tell people that the store does have some really cool stuff in it.
Yeah.
So if you want to check that out.
The elf hat is really sweet.
Yes, I love the elf hat.
And you said that you do have, you know, some areas of growth that you're looking at building. What are your goals for the future of the organization?
Well, we're always expanding just the resources that are on our website. One of the things that we're working on, a big project right now, is even before we started using Harry Potter with our kids, in the early days when our kids were kind of young, Darren is very creative, and he started just kind of coming up with these creatures that lived around our house. And they all had a purpose to them in some way, shape, or form. They were helping the kids to with certain fears or helping with bonding, helping them sleep better. So he kind of started creating these magical creatures around our house. And he even started creating some pictures for the kids. And they really became a great way to bond and connect and also to help the kids feel safe. So right now, we have an illustrator that we're working with. We did a Facebook campaign towards the end of last year to get, we've got it partially funded. She is doing illustrations for all those creatures. Some of them are on our website, but we are actually working on publishing a book, Magical Creatures Around Your Home, that has the creatures. It's kind of going to be a field guide from a child's perspective, and it talks about what the creatures do. The illustrator is doing these great, great illustrations, and then there are bonding creative activities that go along with it. So we're wanting to publish that. In the past, we've done first foster placement survival kits where we got tools into the hands of families, you know, and things like the night lights. And so that kind of thing, you know, if we have the magical creatures get published, then we can create toolkits around those different activities that we would love to give to homes. There's just so much that we can do, you know, basically whatever it takes to help families is kind of our heartbeat, to be that oxygen mask. Oh, another thing that's been really simple that we'd love to expand on is in Knoxville and Nashville, Tennessee, and it's not happening in Knoxville anymore, but in Nashville, Jet's Pizza, once a month, that we, by zip code, we're able to kind of go through our subscribers, and randomly a subscriber is drawn where the family gets a full meal from the pizzas, the sides, the drinks, dessert, everything. That's donated to them. And without fail, ever since we started that, every month, it seems, you know, the families are saying, look, we were at therapists all week long, or we spent the week in the children's hospital, and you don't know just the power of just having one night where they didn't have to think about what are we going to eat, you know. So many of the families, too, are big. You know, the average size of a foster or adoptive family is larger than the typical size of the American family. And this is abroad too, as well. And a lot of families just don't have the money to do those kinds of things. So giving the families experiences, one thing Darren really has a heart for is he's been trying to put together a trip to Universal Studios that would be for foster and adoptive families, where we would have staff that kind of guided them and helped them actually give them tools to help them in the park and help them kind of navigate. And, you know, some of it's just being with other families that, you know, if your 12-year-old has a 2-year-old meltdown, you know, you're around a bunch of people that, you know, hey, we understand, we've been there. Right. But also having folks who know the park well, who can help them, you know, oh, here's a safe, quiet space that nobody, you know, you wouldn't know is there, right. to kind of get the sensory stimulation overload under control, you know, or just helping them with things that we've learned, you know, hydration, protein every couple hours, things like that, that help them have that family dream vacation that everyone dreams of, but so many foster and adoptive families just, it's out of reach for them because of behaviors or because of trauma. You know, it's just too much. But if we can help them kind of have that experience and build those memories together, it's developed so much over the last few years, you know, from where we started. But there's so much that we can do.
Wow, what a wonderful idea. Oh, that's wonderful.
Amazing.
Yeah,
I'm excited myself. I'm very excited to share this, even just this podcast, with people I know whose families are adoption and fostering as part of their family story. So thank you for this.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much, Margie Fink, for being on our podcast today and helping
us. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah. No, this was just wonderful. And I think, you know, you can really see the power of literature in general. And I love that you have this holistic view, that it's not like the children have to be fixed or something, but it's the whole family that needs to be talking about these kinds of issues. I think that is really important, and that Harry Potter can help with that. And as we said earlier, I think J.K. Rowling would totally love that. So we wish you all the best with transfiguring adoption going forward.
Thank you.
Thanks also to our special guests, Louise Freeman and Lana Whited. You brought really great perspectives on this topic, and I think you've really enriched my understanding of how the Harry Potter books, you know, can help people extend empathy and compassion and also understand themselves better.
Well, thank you. It was a real pleasure last year at the Queen City Mischief and Magic Festival to get to meet Margie, to be able to host her at Mary Baldwin University. We had a evening session. We had, you know, some foster parents show up and hear what she had to say. I talked a little bit about my research. It was really a wonderful time. It was really one of the highlights of the festival for me. I'm looking forward to working with her again in the future.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I appreciate, Louise, you were the one who brought Margie and Transfiguring Adoption to our attention at Reading, Writing, Rolling. So I really appreciate you helping us to get the word out. I think this is really powerful. Emily Strand, thanks
hey.
So much to you. I appreciate you being on the show today.
You're very welcome. And you know, Katie, if I can, you know, your last comment is a good reminder to our listeners that if you have a great idea of a topic that, you know, Reading, Writing, Rolling should touch on. I know I've hit Katie up with my ideas, and,
yes.
and other people I know have hit her up with their ideas that have turned out really well. So I think that the show seems always very open to new ideas, especially as we take a deeper and closer look at the Harry Potter series.
Yes. And so if you want to leave a comment, an idea for a future show, any kind of question at all, you can email us at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com. We're also at readwriteroll on Twitter, and we have a Facebook page. I would really be eager to hear from all of you. I'd like to give a big thanks to our technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Thanks for
Woo!
All you do, Emma. Greatest.
Yay!
And as always, we appreciate our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Harry Potter fan site. And they actually have some articles about transfiguring adoption on MuggleNet, which listeners, you may want to check out. Our MuggleNet producers, Lori Beckoff and Ruchi Akula, thank you so much for all you're doing for us. And now, dear listeners, I will leave you with the wisdom of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "Words are, in my not-so-humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." We'll see you next time when we'll be using our words to make some magic.